We're beginning the book of Devarim and Parshas Devarim. And the first thing we have to note is that ordinarily these parshios are learned between Tisha B'Av. As you know, Devarim is always the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av. It's always Shabbat Chazon. And then Vayetchanan is always the Shabbos after Tisha B'Av. It's always Shabbos Nachamu. And what happens is that Parshas Devarim, Vayetchanan, Ekev, and Re'eh, these four parshios that are always in the month of Av, well, they're the parshios of the summer. And even though they have pivotal points that are not discussed anywhere else in the Torah as clearly as here, Parshas Vayetchanan is quite possibly the most important parsha when it comes to Jewish philosophy. And yet most people never learn them the way they should, because these are the summer parshios and you don't have yeshiva. So Baruch Hashem, we have classes online in all of these. This year, for a change, I don't foresee us being able to actually get together and having a parsha shir on Vayetchanan, Ekev, and Re'eh. Although, if you're interested, be in touch and maybe we'll be able to set something up. But this year I have to send you back to the internet. I don't know if it's on Machon Meir's site, but on TorahForMe.org. You could definitely see classes on Vayetchanan, Ekev, and Re'eh, and I encourage you to take the time to do so, because there are concepts of Jewish philosophy that are only recorded clearly there. The whole parsha of Shema Yisrael is in Ekev. In Re'eh you have the parshias of the regalim. In Re'eh you have the parshias of the kosher animals. There are a lot of things in Vayetchanan that you won't find anywhere else. And so take the time to learn these parshios and to know them. Our parsha is the beginning of the book of Devarim. And the book of Devarim is unique from the other books of the Torah. It is Moshe Rabbeinu. It is the only sefer in which Moshe Rabbeinu speaks in first person. The Torah doesn't begin with Moshe saying, "Here's what I wrote down." The Torah begins anonymously. The Torah talks in third person. Bereshit bara Elokim, in the beginning God created. Doesn't tell us who's talking. It is only in the book of Devarim that Moshe identifies himself as the author. And that's why the book of Devarim is referred to as Moshe's book, Sifro Shel Moshe. The book of Devarim is also called Mishne Torah, the repeat of Torah. We have mitzvos that are repeated in the book of Devarim. We have mitzvos that appear only in the book of Devarim. And that leads us to a great question. Was there ever a possibility of divorce before the book of Devarim? If the book of Devarim is written in the 40th year in the desert and only in Parshas Ki Tzetzeh do we discover that there is capacity for divorce, so does that mean there was no capacity for divorce earlier? If in Parshas Bishalach, in Parshas Bo, I'm sorry, the Torah says wear tefillin, yet the Parsha of Shema is only going to be recorded in Vayetchanan and the Parsha of Vehoyim Shemoah is only in Parshas Ekev, so then what kind of tefillin were they wearing for 40 years in the desert if they didn't have the parasha of Shema and Vehoyah and Shemoah? Did they have no mezuzahs because Shema and Vehoyah and Shemoah are only in Vayetchanan and Ekev? And so on and so forth. And this is discussed in the Talmud, and this is discussed in the Ramban, and this is discussed in many places. There's a machlokas in the Talmud as to how exactly the Torah was given. Was it given parshios parshios, or was it given all at once and then it was only recorded in this order? We have the concept that the whole Torah was given at Sinai, which leads us back to this question: what does that mean? So then it was just recorded here in Devarim, it was just reviewed here in Devarim, and as we said, there are different opinions as to how to work this out. The book of Devarim is unique. We have a machlokas whether we learn Hekesh throughout the Torah. We know one of the laws of derivation is Hekesh, where if you have two verses adjacent to one another, we say that teaches us halachos. The fact that two psukim were put adjacent to one another is there to teach you a concept. That's called smuchim. No, so there are two concepts. There is the concept of Hekesh, where if two concepts are within one pasuk, so then we say Hashem put them in one pasuk to teach you that they have common ground. So that we all learn. Everyone agrees you learn a Hekesh. Then you have the concept of Smuchim, which says if you have two different verses, but they're one next to the other, do we say because they are adjacent that that also teaches me that they have common ground? So everyone agrees in the book of Devarim you learn smuchim. In the rest of the Torah it's a machlokas. Chachamim say you do, Rabbi Yehuda says you don't. Rabbi Yehuda says only in the book of Devarim you learn smuchim. Now based on our introduction that this is the book of Moshe and this is the book of review and this is the book that was written between Rosh Chodesh Shvat and Zayin Adar, the last, that's how the book of Devarim begins, telling you this is from Rosh Chodesh Shvat. So you have the month of Shvat plus the 6 or 7 days of Adar. So you have 36 or 37 days where the book of Devarim was written. There's a machlokas. Some midrashim say that year was a leap year, so there were two Adars. But then there's another machlokas. Which month of Adar did Moshe pass away in? So it seems obvious that it was the second Adar. So you could say, okay, the book of Devarim was written in 66 or 67 days. Fine. So it was either 36 or 37 or 66 or 67. Whatever. We know Moshe passed away Zayin Adar, and the book begins in Shvat. Was there another month of Adar? Was it a leap year that year? That's a machlokas. Fine. But at any rate, the book of Devarim is being recorded in a very condensed time period. And so the book of Devarim has unique halachic aspects. The book of Devarim begins with Eila Dvarim Asher Dibel Moshe, the following things Moshe said. Not like Shmos. The Eila Shmos Bnei Yisrael starts anonymously. Not like Bereishis. Not like Vayikra, which begins with Hashem. Hashem calls to Moshe. Not like Bamidbar. Eila Dvarim Asher Dibel Moshe. The book begins with Moshe, not with Hashem. Chazal say that Hashem had an interesting conversation with Moshe. Hashem said to Moshe, I commanded them 2 commandments. You commanded them 8. They didn't listen to my 2, but they did listen to your 8. So I'm going to have 1 book of the Torah named after you, and that's the book of Devarim. This obviously needs a lot of work. The 10 commandments were all from Hashem. The difference was that the first 2, Hashem said directly to the Jewish people. The next 8, the Jewish people couldn't handle. They said, Moshe, you tell us. So Moshe said them over. So we see there's an aspect where Hashem gives Moshe credit for the way we accepted the next 8. Okay, so obviously that needs work. That deserves a class unto itself. Let's go over the parsha quickly. The parsha begins with a record of our journeys. Again, only here we have a tradition that this record is really a series of rebukes that Moshe gave them. He gave it as allusions by mentioning where they were, and really is mentioning what they did there. And Moshe starts reviewing. And he tells them, remember, Hashem told us to start traveling and conquering the land of Israel. And we said, good idea, but we want to send spies. And then that led to the spies coming back and causing us to cry and weep and say that Hashem really hates us and that's why He brought us here. And then you were punished. And that's why Hashem promised that generation would not enter the land of Israel. And Hashem punished me because of you too. And that's why Yoshua is going to lead you in there. And your kids that you thought would die in the wars, well, they're the ones that are going to enter and they're going to have the land of Israel. And then we were destined, Hashem decreed that we would travel. And you wept and you cried, and Hashem didn't give up. The decree was sealed. And so we traveled. And then Hashem said, start traveling. At the end of the 40 years, Hashem had us travel back here, and we conquered the Moabite territory and the Ammonite territory. And then we conquered Sihon and Og. After we conquered Sihon and Og, so we conquered a tremendous number of cities, and we're up to Shvi. And at the end of the parsha, Moshe describes how Reuben and Gad had their portion on the eastern side of the Jordan, and the deal he made with them. And that's at the end of the parsha, Yoshua is commanded that he will succeed in leading us into the land of Israel. So our parsha was its own review of what happened from the beginning of the journeys in the desert till now. And then Beit Hanan begins with Moshe recording how he begged to go in and Hashem said no. So that's in a nutshell, that's our parsha. And now let's see the parsha with more depth. Whenever a person has a position of leadership, it could be a parent in a home, it could be a teacher, it could be a rabbi. So a person has responsibility to help the people move forward in life. And very often that puts a person in a very uncomfortable situation, because most of us advance in life with our own perspectives. And with our own perspectives, we get a lot of things right, but we get certain things wrong. And a parent will sometimes see his kid about to make a big mistake, and as a parent, he feels that he should do something. And the question is, what should you do and how should you do it? We know we have a mitzvah in the Torah of Tochacha. And we would think that the mitzvah of Tochacha involves telling a person, hey buddy, you got to shape up, you got to do different. And that's true when it comes to certain ages. That's what a parent has to do. Every parent finds himself sitting opposite his children eating like pigs. And at some point he has to start telling them that's not the way you eat. And if he's not going to teach them how to be decent individuals, they might learn the hard way or they might never learn. One or the other. And a good parent guides his children. But a good parent also knows that as a child matures and grows, so then he has to gauge what he says, how he says, when he says. Chazal tell us when it comes to tochacha, when it comes to rebuke, you have to be prepared that people don't want to hear what you have to say. And so you have to think very carefully if to say, when to say, how to say, what to say. And that's very difficult. Now, it's a huge challenge, because very often you feel like you're doomed if you do and you're doomed if you don't. If you don't say anything, so who knows what'll happen. And if you do say something, who knows what'll happen. And you're walking a thin line. Now, there are different types of rebuke. The more personal the rebuke, the more dangerous it is. And sometimes the more important it is. And the more important it is, the less likely the individual is to listen to what you have to say. So there are rules of rebuke. But Chazal gave us in different areas, they gave us different rules for rebuke. In our generation, we generally say that it's not our job to rebuke. In our generation, we say that we don't love people enough and they don't know clearly enough that we're coming out of love, and therefore we don't have the obligation to rebuke. If we'd be on a higher level of being able to communicate the love and that they would get it the way they should, and if they were on a higher enough level to appreciate where it's coming from by us, so then there would be what to talk about. Chazal tell us a very scary line. They say that Yaakov did not rebuke Reuven throughout his life, because Yaakov figured, if I rebuke Reuven, Reuven might pack his bags and go and join forces with Esav. Reuven the tzaddik, Reuven who taught us the power of tshuva, Reuven who tried to save Yosef's life, Reuven who was willing to give up his own two children to help the rest of the family, Yaakov says, I can't rebuke him. Who knows what will happen if I give him over the head? So Yaakov waits till his last day when he's on his deathbed, and then it's going to be very clear that he's got nothing to benefit from it and he's not going to repeat it again. And so he tells Reuven, you know, you were too quick to act and you lost from it. His whole life he didn't say a word. Reuven did tshuva without his rebuke.
Is that a legitimate
concern? Chazal quoted as a legitimate concern. Moshe Rabbeinu waits till his dying days, till he knows it's over. And now he's going to rebuke them in the book of Devarim. And the same holds true with Yoshua, and the same holds true with Shmuel. And again, you know, it depends on what the scenario is. Sometimes you have no choice. But you have to realize that when you do have a choice, very often the proper thing is to wait. And sometimes it means waiting till the day you die, and sometimes it means waiting till the right moment. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to rebuke Am Yisrael. The Torah says he only did it after he killed the kingdom of Sichon. Says the Medrash, Moshe was concerned. If he comes and rebukes them, and there's Sichon just across the border, so then some of the Jews, if not all of the Jews, might pack up their bags and switch sides. Same concern as Yaakov with Reuven. Moshe waited till he defeated Sichon and defeated Og. And after he defeated them and they got nowhere to go, so then he comes to them and says, now we got to talk. One of the biggest favors that a person can do for someone else is to give them rebuke. But most of the time, we don't know how to say it or when to say it. And that's why we don't do that for other people. In our day and age, most people are not going to get it right. So we don't. It's rare that you can get it right. So that's why when in doubt, you don't. You gotta do it right. You have no right to do it if you're not going to do it right.
Torah could be also in a form of advice. You're doing Torah in a very undertone way.
So here we have to analyze another question. Firstly, we see that Moshe says it in as allusions. He doesn't come directly in the beginning. He alludes to it. The second thing we see here is that Moshe is talking to the next generation. This isn't the generation that did all those sins. This is their children. So then you see it's a different type of tochacha. And perhaps what Moshe is telling us is that the weaknesses that led us to that, to those sins, are weaknesses of the nation. And so the children have to stop and think, why did the nation do that? And I want us to stop and look at some of the sins of the Jewish people. And what were the causes of the sins? So they complained. That was often the problem. They complained about the man. They complained about the journey. They complained. And one of the things that people do is complain. They complained about the land of Israel. One of the weaknesses of a people, of a congregation, is that they complain. And it's a tremendous weakness. The fact that a person can receive and receive and still complain. A person can complain about their parents. A person can complain about the city, about the government, about the yeshiva. You can complain about everything. Where does it stem from? It stems from a certain lack of appreciation. It stems from a person projecting their own frustration on others. It stems from many problems that a person really has within themselves, and it comes out as an expression of complaint against someone else. That's not to say that the parent, the government, the yeshiva is perfect. No, they're not. But the question is, what do I focus on? Do I think about the supper that I didn't like, or do I think about the lunch that I did like? So a person will say, but I paid. Yeah, you paid, fine. No one's saying there's no room for the complaint. The question is, where is the focus? I often ask...
For the satisfaction?
I think a person has to ask himself the following question. Have you ever expressed appreciation with the same vehemence with which you express your dissatisfaction? There's so much to be appreciative for. And a person can ask himself this question about his davening. A person can ask himself this question about his relationship with his roommate, with his spouse, with his children, with his parents, with anybody that you have a relationship with. And most often you will find yourselves, you will realize that you rarely expressed appreciation. And if you did, it certainly wasn't with the vehemence with which you were prepared to express your dissatisfaction. One of the things I deal very frequently with is helping people who want to write letters of complaints about their experience in the Aliyah process and the Gir process, in their staying at Mechon Meir. And I go along with people. I don't believe it's my job to tell them what to write, but if they want my help and how to write it, fine. I'm there for them. But I think that a person really has to ask himself this question. You get free medical care here? Yeah, but they didn't give me medical insurance for the first 2 years I was here, right? Will you ever write a letter of thanks after living here 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, getting the medical care of the government? Will you ever write a letter of appreciation to anyone the same way you want to write a letter of complaint after the troubles you've had? A person has to ask himself that. So I'm not saying the complaints are wrong. I'm not saying the system's perfect. I'm saying one of the things we see as a recurring flaw of the people is their complaints and their expression of dissatisfaction. Chazal tell us that Moshe said to Am Yisrael, we're going to see it later in the book of Devarim, you are entering the land of Israel today. The Medrash tells us a devastating thought. Moshe says to the people, you are entering Israel today, says the Medrash. He was hinting to them, you're entering and I'm not entering. So what do the people do? They start crying. Moshe's not entering. Oh, we're going to miss you, Moshe. Terrible, Moshe, you're not entering. Says the Medrash, Moshe was hinting it to them because Moshe hoped that they would daven on his behalf. Had the people united and davened on Moshe's behalf, he would have entered the land of Israel. The Medrash says, all the years, every time we had a problem, Moshe was there for us. But the one time that he needed us, we weren't there for him. So Moshe hints it to them. He says, you're entering, I'm not. So what do the people do? They cry, yeah, it's terrible, Moshe, we're so sorry. So Moshe starts crying too. But let's ask ourselves, how did we get there? Why didn't we get the hint? And perhaps every person has to ask himself that question. How many times have we focused on what we want from the system or from the relationship? And how many times did we stop to think how much we owe to the system or the relationship? We know very clearly how to express ourselves when we want something. But how clearly do we express ourselves in showing appreciation? There's a story of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal that whenever he'd eat at a restaurant, at the end of the meal, he'd ask to see the cook. And then he'd go over and tell the cook, thank you very much, the food was delicious. And I can tell you that I heard this in elementary school, and I decided it's an easy thing for me to adopt. So when I go to simchas, when I go to wedding halls or bar mitzvahs or whatever it is, I usually try. If I can only get there, I try to go to the kitchen and tell the staff how delicious the food was. I don't lie. Whatever I ate, I tell them, you know, I tasted this, I tasted that, and it was amazing. It was delicious. I won't compliment something I don't think was good. I'll find something that was good, and I'll compliment it. And if I can't compliment the taste of the food, so I can compliment the beautiful way in which they arranged it. You can always find what to say thank you for. And you'd be surprised how often people tell you, you know, you're the first person to come and tell me thank you. People only come in here when they have complaints. It's very interesting. When I go and I ask, could I talk to the cook? So everyone gets all nervous. Everyone says, what's wrong? And I say, no, I just want to thank him. So then you see suddenly they go from being very concerned to a big smile. The other day I was in a place and I went to say thank you to the manager. I told him, you should know, everything was amazing. I wanted just to thank you. So he said, fine. And he turned around. I said, wait a second. When someone complains about a waiter and someone complains about people here, don't you make a note of it and start thinking of cutting salaries and who knows what? I want you to make a note that someone came and said the waiter was good and the food was good. So I turned around and smiled. And you should have seen the waiter standing there shining from ear to ear. Why not? Why not? If you call customer service and you got good service, why not take the time to tell the manager? I once got a letter from someone that helped me in a phone company or an electric company. They sent me a letter that they were awarded employee of the month, and then they were advanced in their position because I took the time after they helped me to talk to the manager and tell them, you know, they took the time to help me and know what the problem was and help me solve the problem. They did. They really did. They went beyond the call of duty and they took the time to understand the issue. And then I felt that the right thing is that you give a good report. So then I found out that by giving a good report to the manager, I helped the person a lot. Why not? It's a habit that we all have to work on. I also work on it. Because our nature is that we only express ourselves when there are problems. And if you look through the parasha, you'll see that this is a recurring theme. Am Yisrael complains. We are a nation that required a judge for every 10 people. Every 10 people needed a judge. You know, the number of lawyers we have in this country is phenomenal. It's a problem. It's not a positive thing. Moshe, when he records in an our parsha, is recording a point of rebuke. He says, what's wrong with you guys? Why are you always fighting? Why are you always into what are my rights? What am I allowed to demand? Stop. A judge for every 10 people? So many fights? That's what we see. But Moshe doesn't tell them this throughout their life. He waits till the end. Yes? Okay, I'm not saying. The pshat I said is the Sephorno. I'm not saying there aren't other commentaries. Maybe. I don't know. I'm unaware of a commentary that says that, but there are many commentaries I don't know. Could be. I don't know. I don't remember it being Rashi. I don't think so. But could be I forgot. Moshe writes 13 Sifrei Torah. Our Gemara says he wrote it on the day he died. That's why Moshe is going to be called the Mechokek, the great writer. What an author. 13 Sifrei Torah in one day. There's a Medrash that says that he wrote it during this period, from Rosh Chodesh Shvat till Zayin Adar, which is also a nes. It's an unusual feat. He gave each tribe their Sefer Torah and one Sefer Torah that was in the Aron. There was a special Sefer Torah that was called Sefer Torah Ha'azara, the Sefer Torah that was in the temple, and that was the Sefer Torah for many years. It was Moshe's Sefer Torah. Later on it became Ezra's Sefer Torah. That was the Sefer Torah which they referred to whenever they had a question in the tradition. How do you write a Sefer Torah? So that's what the beginning of the parasha says. Moshe clarified things. Moshe called the Jewish people in on Rosh Chodesh Shvat and said, gentlemen, I'm on my way out. If you have any questions, if you have any conflicts, if you have anything in the tradition that you need clarification, come to me. I will clarify it before I go. And Moshe is going to spend this month and 7 days reviewing the Torah with the Jewish people. Moshe is talking to them, to the new generation, the children that are going to enter and conquer the land of Israel. Moshe is talking to them when they have already settled a little bit in the land of Israel. He's already conquered the eastern side of the Jordan. And Moshe's focus is to prepare them for the journey without him. Moshe tells them, I'm not going to be there to answer your questions. And that's also a point of rebuke. Moshe says, it's your fault. And Moshe is telling them that so they should learn from their mistakes. When Moshe was standing there in a moment of pressure, contemplating, talk to the rock, hit to the rock, what should I do? The people upped the pressure. The people started making jokes. The people started making comments. Moshe says, think back. You guys made the situation into a problematic situation. Moshe reminds them that when we came to the border the first time, Moshe said Hashem told us to enter. Had we entered then without any fanfare, without the spies and everything, so then we wouldn't have had to fight a war. The nations would have just said, here, you can have it. God said so. We see you're God's people. But no. They made problems. They're about to enter the land of Israel, and Moshe stopped, and he has to appoint judges. Moshe says, we were about to enter the land of Israel. Why did I have to appoint judges suddenly? Answer, because you guys didn't stop fighting. That wasn't the time to appoint judges. We were days away from entering. You'd think, let's enter the land of Israel, conquer the land, divide the land, set up a justice system. No, we couldn't even move forward without setting up judges. You guys were troublemakers. One judge for each 10 people. We traveled, and you know that the journey was miraculous. You know that we traveled a desert that no one could cross. And we traveled it with 2 million people. How'd we do it? God took care of you. And yet, suddenly everyone was at my doorstep. And here Moshe is giving them another point of rebuke. He says, you had leaders. I set you up judges. You had heads of tribes. No. None of you went to them. You all went to the Rosh Mimshala. You went straight knocking on my door. What's wrong with you? Why'd you come straight to me? There's an order in which things should be. You should go to your judge. You should go to your congressman. Go to your leader. Have them come to me. No. Everyone was at my door, knocking at my door and saying, we want to send spies. Now, initially, I thought you meant for the good. I thought you wanted to see how to conquer it and how to enter and where you'd have good sustenance. I figured it's not a bad idea. Hashem knew what you were planning. When you came to me, you said, we want to send spies. Hashem realized that if you send who you want to send, you're going to send wicked people. And so Hashem said, no, 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 no. They're not going to appoint the spies, Moshe. You're going to appoint the spies. And that's why the spies, even though they sinned, they were at least honest enough to say the land is good. They never said the land is a bad land. They said it's a good land, but people were dying. It's a good land, but we saw that there were unusual people in the land. When the spies came back, you didn't want to go. And what you revealed to me then is that deep down inside you don't believe in Hashem. You heard they were a powerful nation, you said we don't want to go. Now, you saw all the miracles until this point, so you came with an excuse. You said, Hashem, maybe Hashem wants to punish us because we were pagans back in Egypt. You'll notice that whenever people sin, they have a reason that fits with God. People don't say, I'm going against God. People always say, there must be something, I can fit this into it. It's God's fault, and I'll explain to you why. God doesn't like me. God is going to punish me. God is punishing me. Sure, it's an excuse. People, you know how many times people tell me, I feel that God doesn't want me to succeed in this job. You guys are laughing. This is a real line I get very often. I feel that Hashem doesn't want this shirk to work. I feel that Hashem doesn't want this marriage to work. Yeah, but the kids. Yeah, but I feel that Hashem. How many times do people throw their blame on Hashem? Am Yisrael also did. Yeah.
Didn't all these people complain about the land die?
Right.
They're not alive anymore.
So we said in the beginning of the parasha.
Right.
That if Moshe is rebuking over these points, then probably there's what to be learned for future generations too, even though he's talking to their children. and then the nation tries to do tshuva. And Moshe says Hashem wasn't willing to accept it. And the question is why? We know that tshuva works. So there are different reasons given. Number one, chilul Hashem. And chilul Hashem, the Talmud tells us in Rosh Hashanah, the Talmud tells us in Yuma, that chilul Hashem can only be wiped with a person's passing. Meaning a person can do tshuva and has to do tshuva, but Hashem doesn't forgive the sin until a person passes away from the world. Number two, Hashem decreed and promised, I'm not forgoing it. And once there's a promise, so then, so to speak, Hashem says, you can't talk to me about it. You could try to make the future better, but you're not going to change my promise. Number three, as they were sinning, Moshe, Yoshua, and Kalev all tried to persuade them, don't do it. But number four is the scariest one, and that is that when they did tshuva, their tshuva was for fear of punishment. Had they done tshuva out of love, so then it would have worked. But Moshe is telling them, Hashem saw you were just scared of what would happen if you don't enter the land of Israel. Suddenly it dawned on you, this isn't going to be good for us. And that's why, as much as you cried, Hashem wasn't willing to accept it. Because Hashem saw that you didn't go back to the root of things. You didn't say, we want to connect to Hashem. You didn't come and work on your love of Hashem. You said, uh-oh, this isn't so good. Hashem, please, no, we regret it. Hashem said, no, if your regret is for fear, okay, we'll make it work. It's not true regret. It's not on the level it should be. says that when Moshe tried to establish judges, so it says, he said, gather for me people who are smart, people who have understanding, nevonim. And then it says when he finally gathered them, it says he gathered people who were smart. It doesn't say he got nevonim, people who have understanding. And so the Medrash says that teaches us that it's not so easy to find someone who is nevon. You can find smart people, but people with understanding are not so easy to come by. It says that the people had clothing that were self-cleaning. They had mun that could change into any flavor. They had waters that tasted of any drink they chose. So the simple reading of that medrash is simply like it says. One of the midrashim, the Ma'or HaAfeila, offers the following interpretation. And this gives us an insight into how to understand midrashim. He says, when it says that the man had multiple flavors, so the medrash says it plainly, that whatever he wanted the man to taste like, it would taste like. What it means is that the man was a food that you could cook and bake and fry and do whatever you wanted with it, and it would absorb whatever tasted you wanted, and you can make tremendous number of dishes from it. That's the idea that Chazal were saying, that it could have any flavor. That's how he interprets it. When it says the waters had any flavor, so it means that the waters flowed through the sand wherever they were. And in different places, there are different minerals in the sand, and so the water had different flavors depending on where they camped. And when it says that their clothing were perfect, so what it means is they left Egypt with a lot of clothing, and they had such a huge wardrobe coming out of Egypt that they had enough that their clothing never wore thin. So that's his interpretation, and we have to know that there are two approaches to Midrashim. You find in the Rishonim, some say when the Medrash says it like that, when the Pasuk says it like that, that's what it means. And some say you have to see the depth behind it, that the Medrash words it in simplistic form, but it means it. It means the way we just said. This is an example. Moshe says that when the people of that generation passed away, Hashem spoke to me Lemo. And from here our sages teach us that throughout the years that we were in the desert, Hashem never spoke to Moshe in a close way. There was never Vayomer Hashem. It was always Vaydaber Hashem. And the introduction with which the speech begins is indicative of the closeness of the speech. Here we see a very important concept. Chazal tell us that our leaders have capacity to grow based on where their people are. Chazal say in the generation of Hillel, there were tens of students who could have had prophecy like Moshe, but the generation wasn't fit for it. Chazal say in many generations you had great sages who were fit for prophecy, but the people weren't fit for it. And even Moshe, there were the 38 years he was in the desert where he did not get the prophecy that he was fit for because the people weren't fit for it. And here we see a fantastic connection between the leader and the people. Even the leader's spiritual capacity is intertwined with the people's spiritual capacity. He has to help them grow, but he is also limited by their growth. The greater they are, the greater he can be. He can have tremendous potential, but he will not be able to realize that potential if the people aren't on a higher level. At the end of the parasha, we have a description of Og, the giant. And here again, we see a difference between the Midrashim and the way some of the commentaries explain. The Medrash says Og used to have a necklace of clouds. Og was such a giant. The Medrash says Og lifted a mountain that was the size of the camp of Israel, and he took it to drop it on the people of Israel and demolish them in one shot. That's the Medrash. It's a Gemara in Brachos. The Rambam says, it says that Og's bed was 9 amos long. So you could say it means 9 amos is the length of Og's amma. 9 amos, when you took Og's arm, you'd measure 9 arm lengths of Og, so it doesn't tell you anything, right? It doesn't tell you as big as Og was, so proportionately his arms were that big. If you figure, you know, they say if you extend your hands this way, it's about your height. So okay, so 9 arms length, okay, that makes sense, that's a big enough bed for each person depending on his arm. The Rambam says no. 9 amos means 9 amos. And the Rambam says if the average person has a bed that's about a third longer than their own height, so then Og's bed was about a third longer than his height, which puts Og at 6 amos long. Well, okay, 6 amos long is approximately, let's say, each amos is 22 inches, let's say 2 feet. So it's a 12-footer. So Og was about 12 feet tall. So a tall person is about 6 feet tall. So Og was double that. So that's what the Rambam says. So our parsha took us with a great review of our journeys in the desert, and our parsha concludes with the success of dividing the land between the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, and finally with Yehoshua, who is set up as leader and is told that just as we conquered these two kings, Sihon and Og, so too we will conquer them. Hashem says, fear them not, because Hashem is fighting for you. We are approaching Tisha B'Av. This Shabbos is Shabbos Chazon. We await the day in which we will fear them not. Hashem is fighting for us. As we approach Tisha B'Av, we have to know that there are two aspects of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av involves mourning the past, mourning the destruction, and also fixing the present. Recognizing that every generation in which the Beis HaMikdash was not built, Chazal tells it's as though the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in that generation. And so each person has to ask himself how he can better himself and who he can make peace with. We know that we're still contending with the sins of the Second Temple, the sins of Sinat Chinam, and the solutions of that is to obliterate the Sinat Chinam. And everyone has that thought within himself, I can make peace with everyone but him. Okay, so then that but him is the person with whom we have to make peace with. So we should merit to fix ourselves, and then Be'ezrat Hashem, Tisha B'Av will become the moed that it's supposed to be, a day of happiness. Shabbat Shalom.